Good evening. I'm Dave DeForest in Washington. This is Crossroads Asia. Tonight on our program, the search continues for victims of a South Korean boat accident. Labor activism increases in China. These stories and more in the next half hour on VOA's Crossroads Asia. Rescue efforts in South Korea entered a second day today. Officials are trying to find nearly 300 people, mostly high school students, who remain missing after a passenger ferry capsized and sank. Daniel Scharf reports from Seoul.
A massive effort continued Thursday to rescue hundreds of students trapped in a capsized ferry off South Korea's southern coast. Korean television showed scores of military and commercial ships and helicopters circling around the tip of the ship's hull, the only visible part above the water. Yonhap News Agency reports over 500 military and Coast Guard divers were being mobilized to search in and around the sunken vessel. But murky waters and a strong current have slowed efforts. Three divers trying to enter the ferry had been swept away, but were later rescued. Hopes are fading for finding survivors still on board after more than a day in cold water. Oh Pyong-hwan is a father of a missing high school student. Like many parents, he is upset with the pace of the search effort, despite government pledges to continue the search against challenging conditions. He says on Wednesday there was no rescue. They did not even go near the shipwreck. He says early this morning he visited the site and there were salvage personnel working in pairs, diving in and out of the sea. However, he says, due to poor visibility, they could not get into the ship, just dived around it down to about 17 meters. In the end, he says, they did not do anything. Now they are just getting started. Misinformation and rumors have compounded the grief and anxiety of parents and relatives staying at a nearby gymnasium. Angry parents surrounded South Korea's Prime Minister, Chung Hong-won, when he visited the gymnasium, demanding answers. News reports Thursday of text messages coming from survivors trapped on board the ship were later retracted. Shortly after the ship began sinking Wednesday, South Korean authorities reported most of the 475 passengers had been rescued, including all of the students. But just minutes later, authorities cut the number in half, and the scale of the tragedy became clearer. When the ship began to sink, survivors say the ferry operators instructed passengers not to move. South Korean media reports say the captain of the ferry, Lee Jun-seok, was one of the first to abandon ship. He was shown on Korean TV surrounded by reporters while wearing a gray hoodie and with his head bowed to hide his face. He mumbles to reporters, saying he is extremely sorry and deeply ashamed. He says he does not know what to say. The Coast Guard questioned Lee, and one official says he strayed from the route recommended by the Ocean and Fisheries Ministry. It is still not clear what caused the 6,300-ton vessel to sink. But passengers say they heard a loud noise, leading many to speculate the ship ran aground or hit a rock. Captain Lee insisted to a South Korean newspaper he did not hit anything and that the ship just began to sink. Lee was filling in for the ship's regular captain, who was on vacation. Among the missing are at least three foreigners, two from the Philippines and one from Russia. China's Xinhua News Agency reported two Chinese citizens were also on board. As part of search and rescue efforts, at least two salvage cranes are expected to arrive Friday to help lift the sunken ship. Daniel Scharf, VOA News, Seoul.
Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott says a robotic submarine scanning the Indian Ocean floor for a missing Malaysian jetliner will finish its current search within a week. Mr. Abbott told the Wall Street Journal if the submarine does not find any wreckage by then, authorities will stop, regroup, and reconsider how to proceed. This is Crossroads Asia on the Voice of America. I'm Dave DeForest in Washington.
Border Crossings on VOA. It's where we turn over control of the show to you. Hi, this is Larry London, inviting you to join me every Monday through Friday at 15 hours Universal Time online at voanews.com and on VOA for your requests and dedications. Your show, Border Crossings, weekdays at 15 hours Universal Time on voanews.com and The Voice of America.
A nearly two-week-old strike by thousands of workers at a factory in China's southern Guangdong province is seen as the latest instance of a rise of labor activism in China. The dispute at the Taiwan-operated Yuyan shoe factory in Dongguan centers around the amount the company has been taking from worker paychecks for social insurance as well as medical and housing expenses. Jeffrey Crothall, communications director at the Hong Kong-based China Labor Bulletin, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the issues sparking the protests go beyond wages and benefits to include working conditions.
We're talking about excessive overtime here. Factory workers will routinely do 10-hour days, even 11-hour days, 6 days a week. They're subject to abuse from management. They're often cheated out of their benefits as well. I mean, this is basically the cause of the massive strike at the Yuyan factory in Dongguan. The workers have just realized that for many, many years, they've been cheated out of their full pension and social insurance payments, and they want that money back.
Are these also impacting other foreign-operated companies and domestic firms?
Oh, yes. The labor unrest affects all sectors and all parts of China. It's not just southern China. It's pretty much over the entire country, not just factories, but transport workers, teachers. There's a strike by teachers in the middle of China in a place that no one's ever heard of. It's been going on for a week now. And the point to remember here is that this is just the strikes and worker protests that we record. I mean, it's probably just the tip of the iceberg of what's really happening.
Jonathan Isaac, special counsel on employment and labor issues at the law firm of Baker & McKenzie in Hong Kong, says labor activism is more common among younger Chinese workers.
Number one, we're dealing with a younger generation of migrant workers, whereas in the past they were just willing to, older migrant workers were just willing to work under whatever conditions. Newer, younger migrant workers are more educated. They're much more aware of their legal rights, and they're not as afraid of losing their jobs because they can go and try to find other work. And they have a long-term goal of settling down in the big coastal cities where cost of living is higher. So they are much more willing to demand higher pay than their parents were, who may have thought, oh, when we're done working, we're going to return back to our hometown.
And the issues primarily have to do with wages and benefits, or are there other issues involved like working conditions?
In particular, unsafe working conditions oftentimes are also a source of the strikes. Another source of these strikes are general company restructurings. Some workers, particularly if they've worked at a factory for a long time, they're concerned that they may not be able to find jobs elsewhere if they are very senior. So they are much more nervous if there's a factory shutdown or a factory restructuring about what severance pay they're going to receive and their future job prospects.
What is this doing to business, both foreign-owned and domestic businesses? Are some foreign firms reconsidering locating to China because of this this activism?
We see this more on the low-end manufacturing side because it's a low-margin business. So because of increasing labor costs, not only because of increased labor activism, but also because of increased minimum wage levels and tight labor market leads to companies having to increase wages to attract talent. Low-end manufacturing companies, a lot of them are relocating to other countries or relocating to the interior of China. But other higher-end manufacturing companies or service companies, we still see them going into China because of the huge domestic market and because of infrastructure is still better than in other countries.
David Kelly, research director at the Beijing-based China Policy, says the labor shortage in Guangdong province has become more acute in recent years.
They reflect big changes in the macro environment. They're changes in the demography, which mean that people have other things that they want to do rather than go and live under these conditions, which are rather like a barracks conditions in Guangdong. So then this means that there is a kind of seller's market in the labor market. It's hard to find other people. So there is more incentive to take industrial action. Then there are other questions, of course, that crop up at that point, what the packages are, what the actual circumstances are in different places and in different companies.
Is the one-child policy in China finally catching up to Beijing?
Well, certainly Beijing has now introduced what we call the two-child policy. That is to say, if either of two parents are a single child, there is now a policy for them to have a legal second child. But this cannot have an effect on the labor markets immediately. It's starting to happen, but it will not affect this balance and this labor shortage until those new children come of age, which is about 20 years away.
Is this part of just a general social ferment that's ongoing in China? Is this just one aspect of it?
No, I think what you see is that as China moves up the industrial ladder economically, labor costs will go up. This is a pretty widespread principle. People look at the Chinese population and say, well, this huge, 1.4 billion population, it's like an endless store of labor power. But it is not, because large proportions of the population are not of working age. They're either older or younger than working age. And then the incentives that lead people to go down to Guangdong and to the factories are quite complicated. They might prefer to be somewhere else. And so that factory has to raise its package.
What's the government trying to do about it?
The government wants to remove the sources of instability as a priority. The name of the game is what we call corporatism. That is, labor sits down with business and they come to a harmonious agreement which is overseen by the authorities, and they try to keep union action to a minimum. They don't like wildcat strikes. You will see strike action is usually against foreign companies. There'll not be so much of this in a Chinese organization.
Chinese wages have been steadily rising since the global financial downturn of 2008, but so has the cost of living. Kelly says while many workers are emboldened to demand more, the concern is that more foreign firms, unable to meet labor demands, will simply move their factories elsewhere to countries such as Vietnam and Bangladesh, where labor costs are lower. Millions of Indians headed to the polls today as the country held their biggest round of its ongoing general election. Anjana Pasricha has a report from New Delhi.
The 121 parliamentary seats for which voters lined up to choose lawmakers spanned Kashmir in the far north to the information technology hub, Bangalore, in the south. Involving 12 states, the fifth day of polling is a high-stakes round for both the opposition Bharatiya Janata Party and the ruling Congress Party. The latest opinion poll shows the BJP with its allies reaching the halfway mark in Parliament. But crucial for clinching the winning number will be the BJP's performance in battleground states such as Karnataka and its bastions such as Rajasthan, Madhya Pradesh and Chhattisgarh, where voting was held Thursday. Satish Misra is a political analyst at New Delhi's Observer Research Foundation.
So they will have to retain the number of seats and improve upon it from 2009 performance so that they can reach within the 272 required number of seats.
While BJP is promising development and good governance, the Congress Party is projecting itself as a pro-poor, inclusive party which will protect the country's secular identity. In the sharpest attack yet on the BJP, Congress Party Chief Sonia Gandhi urged the nation in a rare three-minute paid televised address Monday night to reject divisive and autocratic forces and those whose vision was clouded by hatred and falsehood. She did not name the BJP or its prime ministerial candidate, Narendra Modi, directly. Modi has been accused of not doing enough to stop sectarian violence in his Gujarat state in 2002. Critics have voiced fears of an anti-Muslim bias and accuse him of being authoritarian.
Is chunav mein
Gandhi said, her party is fighting to protect the nation from those who want to divide it. However, analyst Satish Misra doubts whether Sonia Gandhi's appeal will influence voters.
The fact of the matter is that in a political environment where the Congress is suffering from anti-incumbency and negative image, which is the burden of the last 10 years of various alleged scandals and scams, naturally, people are looking for an alternative, and Modi has been the only choice left to the people. There are not many choices.
The Congress party's image has taken another blow in recent days, with the former media advisor to Prime Minister Manmohan Singh and a senior bureaucrat in the government releasing books portraying him as a weak leader and showing Sonia Gandhi as the wielder of real power. The revelations were not startling, but they provided more fodder to the BJP, which is promising strong leadership under Modi. Polling still has to be held for more than half of the 543 seats and will be completed by May 12th. Voter turnout has been high so far, which pollsters say is an indication of a desire for change. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Trying to understand North Korea has been compared to trying to see clearly through frosted glass. The North has opened up slightly in recent years, allowing some visitors the chance to see a culture that looks mysterious to outsiders. Celebrity ghostwriter Michael Malice went to Pyongyang in 2012 and collected English-language North Korean propaganda books, from which he has been able to write a humorous yet chilling book titled Dear Reader, the Unauthorized Autobiography of Kim Jong-il, using the first person to write the book as if it was in Kim Jong-il's own words. Malice brings us a clearer view of the very serious methods behind North Korea's madness.
So much of our reporting and understanding of North Korea is from a Western context. At the very least, it would have to be from an Eastern Soviet context, but you have to combine that with, you know, Far East Asia and all these other elements, feudalism, to get a good understanding. So most of these philosophies are completely foreign in every sense to the American mindset and the Western mindset at large. So it makes it very, very hard for the typical person to have any idea of what's going on over there, other than the fact that it looks really weird to our senses.
This must have been a lot of fun for you to write and discuss as you were putting it together.
Oh, it was not fun in the slightest. The backstory to creating this book was nightmarish. I went to Pyongyang, I got armfuls of the propaganda, and I slogged through all of these communist texts, and they are so tedious and mind-numbing, it's almost impossible to describe, and repetitive, of course. So I had to read 60 books to get a kind of a view of how North Koreans see themselves, how, you know, Kim Jong-il's presented there, and then to adapt it in a palatable way in a first-person perspective. So if you feel that it seems fun, then I've done my job, because it certainly wasn't. I highly recommend people read Dear Reader so that they don't have to do the hard work that I did, because I assure you these books are not interesting in the original.
Well, I guess all these volumes trumps Mao's little red book.
Yeah. Well, clearly having a 3-volume book on the Juche idea is far superior than a little red one, right? They don't have a little red book. They have many, many big green books and blue books and every color you would like.
We've heard so many stories of people visiting Pyongyang and being told Kim Jong-il discovered this, created that.
Yeah, well, some of those stories are actually true. For example, there's a very famous story that people in the West make fun of that says that Kim Jong-il invented the hamburger. What the actual claim was is that Kim Jong-il introduced the hamburger to North Korea. And in fact, when you are an absolute dictator, anything that happens in the country is only going to be by virtue of your privilege. So it's a fact that he introduced the hamburger in North Korea. Anything that happens in North Korea is a function of his giving the green light to it.
Now, I was reading the back cover, and one of the bullet points was how he can shrink time. What's that about?
This is my favorite story, because in the literature, they claim that Kim Jong-il can shrink time, and it's absolutely true that he can shrink time, and this is what they mean by it. He's at a conference, and there's a speaker speaking, and he's listening to the speaker, and he's, you know, filling out some forms, and people are interrupting him to ask for his opinion on things. And at one point, the speaker stops, and Kim Jong-il says, "Why are you stopping?" And the speaker says, "Well, you're doing these other things." And Kim Jong-il says, "I can do all these things at once. I can shrink time." And everyone's shocked. And when I told this story to my friend, she goes, does he mean multitasking? And yes, that is exactly what he means. And apparently Kim Jong-un is the only person in North Korea who's capable of doing more than one thing at once.
What were some of the other interesting facts, if you will, that you came across as you were putting this together?
I talk about this in the book. When he was in middle school, he was able to, you know, take apart a bus and put it back together. He can read at the superhuman levels. And he's just capable, when he was in kindergarten, of doing kind of higher-level calculus sort of calculations. So he is a boy wonder, that's for sure. And but for him, you know, the claim goes, North Korea would you know, be going to hell.
And apparently his first outing at golf was very good, too.
Yeah, well, a lot of these Western stories that have permeated here have not been in the North Korean propaganda because golf is a Western game. And according to the North Korean ideology, the Juche idea, anything foreign is bad. They want Korean sports for Koreans. They want Korean magic tricks, Korean gymnastics, all these other things. So they never make references to things like golf or basketball, for example, or even Western films.
Interesting, given the fact that Kim Jong-il was quite a movie buff, into Western culture of all sorts.
Yes, as I talk about in Dear Reader, Kim Jong-il's first big accomplishment in North Korea was remaking their movie industry and, in fact, remaking all their arts. And very famously in their literature, he sits down with the producers who were working at the time when he was charged with remaking the movie industry, and he said, we have to throw out all these Western ideas, and all movies have to be about glorifying the great leader Kim Il-sung and the revolution. And you can imagine what it must be like for a nation where entertainment all has the same premise, which is North Korea's great, Kim Il-sung is great, and the outside world is ready to attack us at any moment. And as soon as we let our guard down, you know, we'll be decimated and destroyed.
What an interesting change it has been to have his son, who wasn't even his eldest son, take over. He let things in very publicly, like basketball and Dennis Rodman.
It's very unusual. In 1994, when Kim Jong-il took over as the leader after his father's death, his campaign slogan literally was, do not expect any change from me. His promise, perhaps the first politician in history, is, I will stay the course absolutely and in every way. And in fact, one of the reasons we know that Kim Jong-un was given the leadership role over his two elder brothers is that he also promised to stay the course. I think it's a function of his youth that he's willing to kind of allow in these Western influences, because not only is North Korea the most xenophobic country on earth, it is also the most homogenous country on earth. So they are virulently racist in all their views, and they condemn South Korea for ruining the Korean blood by interbreeding with us evil Westerners.
There's truth and absurdity, and then putting it into the first person just nails it.
Yeah, I have him almost be this kind of like Milton Satan, very seductive figure, because at the beginning you're laughing at him, at his ridiculousness, and the later it gets, once you're kind of on the hook, you realize this isn't funny at all. And when you have someone boasting in the same tone about his great math skills and later boasting about public executions and concentration camps, then you realize this is happening right now. We laugh at their antics, but part of these antics are the worst human rights abuses for the last 100 years. It's really kind of a transition ride I take the reader on. And if they want to go to kimjongilbook.com, you can read the first chapter for yourself and see where I'm going with this.
Michael Malice, author of Dear Reader, the unauthorized autobiography of Kim Jong-il, published by Create Space Independent Publishing Platform. A court in Thailand has charged two journalists with defamation for republishing parts of a story that accused the Thai Navy of trafficking Rohingya Muslim refugees who fled Burma. The Australian editor, Alan Morrison, and his Thai colleague, Chutima Siddhasethian, also were charged with violating the country's Computer Crimes Act. They face up to 7 years in prison and a $3,000 fine if convicted. Both appeared before a court in Phuket to hear the charges today. Morrison slammed the case, saying it represents an ongoing war on media freedom in Thailand. Well, that's it for today. Thanks for joining us on Crossroads Asia. I'm Dave DeForest, sitting in today for Sarah Williams. By the way, you can drop us a line at containing your thoughts and comments by email at voanews@voanews.com. Crossroads Asia is also available for download. Visit our podcast page at voanews.com or search for Crossroads Asia in iTunes. Stay with us now for International Edition.